We're now in the 24th chapter of Deuteronomy, ready to begin at the 5th verse. This area of the Bible is still concerned with giving interpretations of the law of Moses regarding various and sundry situations in life. The 5th verse says, "When a man has taken a new wife, he shall not go out to war, neither shall he be charged with any business, but he shall be free at home 1 year, and shall cheer up his wife, which he hath taken." This rule shows the true feeling that God has for marriage and the great importance of marriage and the family. When a man has taken a new wife, then he was to be relieved from all of the duties of war. Also, he was not to be charged with any business. He was to be allowed to stay free at home 1 year and cheer up his wife, which he hath taken. Now, what that really means is that this couple was to be given 1 year, at least, in which they could be together, they could get to know each other better, they could reaffirm their love, they could work out any of the minor difficulties that they might have, and have a deeper attachment for each other at the end of that year than had they not been allowed to do this. And I'm sure this is designed to deepen the ties of marriage, to allow them to go through this period of adjustment in the first year of marriage that would be so important to building a good, firm foundation for a happy and productive marriage. And it would also allow for the man to be freed from a situation that would interfere with the initial communication that this new husband and wife would have with each other. A communication which is so vital for the establishment of a firm and lasting marriage. We today should take some lessons from this, from this great principle that's laid down here. It seems that it is intended that a husband and wife be together. It is intended that they, especially in the initial part of their marriage, try to avoid prolonged separations that would tend to cause them to destroy their relationship, that would tend to allow them to have unusual temptations to be unfaithful or to turn to somebody else for companionship. They're to avoid a situation that would cultivate any kind of discord between them. So this is a very sound rule that we would do well to adhere to today. Verse 6, "No man shall take the nether or the upper millstone to pledge, for he taketh a man's life to pledge." Now here he's talking about a creditor who would take something from a debtor to pledge, or who would take some kind of security to back up the debt. And this is mentioned again in the later part of this chapter, a few verses down, but this seems to be out of place up here, but we'll go ahead and talk about it since it's here. No man should take the nether or the upper millstone to pledge. That is, he was not to take the hand stone or the small stone that would be used at home to grind the meal for the family, or the upper millstone, which would be a commercial public a stone that a man used to make a living with and ground the meal for the community. These were not to be taken to pledge. They were not to be usurped as collateral or held over a debt, because in doing so, he says, he taketh a man's life to pledge. This is the way that a man makes a living. It's the way he provides for his family, and it's also the way that the community is provided for by having this upper millstone. Verse 7, "If a man be found stealing any of his brethren of the children of Israel, and making merchandise of him, or selleth him, then that thief shall die, and thou shalt put evil away from among you." This verse is really talking about such things as kidnapping, stealing any of his brethren of the children of Israel. It was strictly forbidden here to practice kidnapping, forbidden to steal anyone and sell him as a slave, or to make merchandise of him in any kind of way, to force him against his will to be in some captivity that was not a lawful thing. He's considered to be a thief. He was to die. and thou shalt put evil away from among you. And even today in our land, we also have stern laws against kidnapping, laws that could very well lead to capital punishment. Verse 8, take heed in the plague of leprosy, that thou observe diligently and do according to all that the priest, the Levite, shall teach you. As I commanded them, so shall ye observe to do. Now this plague of leprosy was a disease, but it seems to be considered more than just a disease. It seems to be considered a form of punishment that God would mete out upon those who needed to have it in the form of a plague. As you know, leprosy affected the skin. It made the skin scab up and slough off and wither away and turn white, and the hair would turn white. And it was a contagious disease also. And the person who had it would have to observe diligently and do according to all that the priest, the Levite, should teach you. It was something that was taken care of by a religious act rather than a medical treatment. And they went to the priests. And the priest told them what to do. The priest made the decision whether they should be in quarantine for 7 days or longer. They also made the decision as to whether they should be declared to be unclean. And before they could again be clean and come back into the camp and be among the people, the priest had to give his approval to that. And so he says, as I commanded them, so shall you observe to do. And he did give a lot of commandments to the priest. These are found in Leviticus 13th chapter. And many things are said there about the diagnosing and the handling of these cases of leprosy. Then he says in verse 9, remember what the Lord thy God did unto Miriam by the way after that you were come forth out of Egypt. Now what happened here is Miriam and Aaron rebelled against Moses. And because of that, Miriam was smitten with this plague of leprosy. And as soon as Moses saw that it was leprosy, he prayed to God to heal her. But God required that she go out of the camp for 7 days, go through this period of being isolated from the camp because of her leprosy, which really came on because of her disobedience. And so even though she was a prophetess, even though she was the sister of the great prophet Moses and the high priest Aaron, she still had to take a form of punishment with leprosy because of her sin. And so he's calling here to mind that they are to remember what the Lord thy God did unto Miriam by the way after that you come out of Egypt. They were to remember this case of Miriam, and so have it that she couldn't just take a shortcut and be suddenly healed of leprosy. She had to be quarantined and treated as though she were unclean for 7 days. And so it is with anyone else that has this plague. They must proceed according to the law. They're not to take matters into their own hands. They're not to go to somebody else for help. They're to go to the priest and then do according to what the Lord has instructed the priests. And so he's just reaffirming here the teaching about leprosy in verses 8 and 9. Verse 10, when thou dost lend thy brother anything, thou shalt not go into his house to fetch his pledge. Now, we're getting back to the subject that we had earlier in verse 6 about whether or not you could take a millstone to pledge, which you couldn't. When you lent the brother anything, and there was a pledge coming to stand in good as collateral for this thing that you loaned, then you could not go into his house to fetch the pledge. That is, it was the brother's privilege and prerogative to bring the thing that he wanted you to have as a pledge, and you couldn't go and pick among his articles and enter into his house and decide what you wanted to take of his for a pledge. His house was a sanctified area. It was an area of refuge, and you had no right to enter in and take what you wanted from that house. Verse 11, thou shalt stand abroad, and the man to whom thou dost lend shall bring out the pledge abroad unto thee. So you were to stay well clear of the house, and the man that owed you the pledge, he was to bring it out to you, the thing he'd chosen for you to have, and you had no right even to go into his house. much less to choose what you wanted from his belongings. Further, he says in verse 12, "And if the man be poor, thou shalt not sleep with his pledge." Now, I think what this really means, that you were not to take his bedclothes, you were not to take the articles that he used in his sleeping as a pledge. And you were not to sleep with his pledge. That is, you weren't to take the thing he used and then you use it for your sleep, because you weren't to have it. In any case, thou shalt deliver him the pledge again when the sun goeth down, that he may sleep in his own raiment and bless thee. So, if you did take an article of this nature, you were to bring it again when the sun went down, so that he could sleep in his own raiment. And what this probably really means is, you were not to take these articles, because to take them during the day and have to give them back at night would be really more trouble than you would get benefit out of it. And I think this is a way of saying that you were not to take these type of things as a pledge. And what he is saying here really is that those who loan money, the creditors, are to have some kind of compassion and some kind of understanding for the circumstances and the plight of those to whom they would loan the money. That would be the debtors. And so the debtor then should be given a form of dignity, allowed to keep his necessities, the things that he would use as bare necessities and the things he would use to make a living. He was to be allowed to keep those things, and the compassion then was shown by the one who did the loaning. And then he says, he may sleep in his own raiment and bless thee. That is, now the debtor, the one who owed the debt and the one who was to provide the pledge, he was to recognize the kindness and the compassion of his creditor, and as a result, he was to bless him. This would be that he would desire good things to happen to him. He would work so that good things would happen to him, and he would pray to God on his behalf. Now, too often we have those that lend, the creditors, who are unsympathetic. They're calloused. They're not aware of the condition and the circumstances of those to whom they loan money. They just simply want what's theirs, and they want to get it at any and all costs. But also, too often, we have those who do the borrowing, who are thoughtless to the ones from whom they borrowed, and they're not willing to bless them, they're not willing to pray for them, they're not willing to appreciate the good and the kindness and the leniency that the creditors do show. So it's a two-way street, and he's outlining both sides of it here. You want to callously take these pledges and take the wrong thing to pledge. You want to enter into the man's house. You would return what he would sleep in his own raiment if you did take that. And then he in turn would bless thee. And then he concludes that verse by saying, "And it shall be righteousness unto thee before the Lord thy God." This was to bring about righteousness. This would be a good situation, one that God approved of in the situation of the lender and the lendee. Verse 14, "Thou shalt not oppress an hired servant that is poor and needy, whether he be of thy brethren or of thy strangers that are in thy land within thy gates. At his day thou shalt give him his hire, neither shall the sun go down upon it, for he is poor, and setteth his heart upon it, lest he cry against thee unto the Lord, and it be sin unto thee." This rule very plainly forbids them to oppress a hired servant. There is one thing now about a servant or a hired person rendering the proper amount of work to his master, to his employer. But there's also another thing about the master or the employer having the proper attitude toward the hired servant. He says, "Thou shalt not oppress an hired servant that is poor and needy." Assuming that most people doing this kind of menial work that he's talking about here, they work day by day and they get paid at the end of the day. They don't have anything really ahead. They're living a hand-to-mouth existence. They're poor and needy, and so you have no right to oppress them. You must treat them just. You must give everything that they have coming to them, give it to them at the due time. Thou shalt not oppress an hired servant that is poor and needy, whether he be of thy brethren or of thy strangers that are in thy land within thy gates. That is, it didn't matter whether he were a brother, a fellow Israelite, or whether he were a member of another nation who happened to be residing in Israel and working as a servant. You had to treat them the same. You could not oppress. You could not hold back that which was his. This thought is also given over in the book of Job. Job 31, beginning with the 13th verse or the 15th verse. If I did despise the cause of my manservant or of my maidservant, and they continued with me, what shall I do then when God riseth up? And when he visiteth, what shall I answer him? Did not he that made me in the womb make him? Did not one fashion us in the womb? And the thought there in Job is that God made both. He made the servant and he made the master. He made the employee and he made the employer. And so if you do defraud this servant, remember, the same God who made him also made you, and you have to answer to that same God. You both answer to the same God. And so you're going to have to come up with an answer. What are you going to say to God for treating a fellow human being like that? That's what this is really saying. How are you going to answer God about it? So in verse 15 he says, at his day shalt thou give him his hire. Now in Matthew 20 verse 8, where Jesus gave the parable of the laborers in the vineyard, some started at an early hour of the day and worked all day for a certain amount, and others started later in the day. So those he hired at the 11th hour, he paid the same wage. And the thought I want to get is, at the end of the day, he paid them. That was the customary thing, to pay them at the end of the day. So he says here in verse 15, at his day, that is, at the end of his day, thou shalt give him his hire. Pay him what he has due. Neither shall the sun go down upon it. That is, it was to be done before the sun went down. That's probably could be even a figurative thing, but still, it gives you a point of reference. Before the day was over, before the daylight part of the day was over, he was to be paid his wages. And he gives the reason, for he is poor and setteth his heart upon it. Now here's a man who needed the money. He wanted the money. He'd already worked for the money. He had his heart set upon it. And so you had no right to hold it back from him. And in case he had no recourse to you, who else could he turn to? He's going to turn to this God who made him and who made you. So he says, lest he cry against thee unto the Lord, and it be sin unto thee. So if he had it withheld from him, and he had to appeal to the Lord for help due to the fact that you had held back his wages, it's sin to you. And this very same idea is expressed in the book of James, where James is criticizing those people who oppress the poor. In James 5, verse 4, behold the hire of the laborers who have reaped down your fields, which is kept back by fraud, crieth, and the cries of them which have reaped are entered into the ears of the Lord of Sabaoth, or the Lord of hosts. So those who have worked for you, you've kept back the hire, you kept back the price, you kept it back by fraud, then James says that the cries of them which have reaped are entered into the ears of the Lord of Sabaoth. The Lord hears those that have been abused. He hears those that have been mistreated. Now, if we mistreat somebody, and God hears that person cry because of the abuse that they've had, then you can see how that it's going to be sin to us. We'll be condemned, just as James made the condemnation in the New Testament, and here in Deuteronomy 24, verse 15, the condemnation is made in the Old Testament. Lest it cry against thee unto the Lord, and it be sin unto thee. Verse 16, the fathers shall not be put to death for the children, neither shall the children be put to death for the fathers. Every man shall be put to death for his own sin. This principle just simply relates the fact that when children commit sin, and I'm sure that there is some age here that they are referring to, then the children should be responsible for their sin. They should bear the burden of it. They should pay the consequences of it. And the sin that would be unto death, and the children would be put to death for their own sin. And also, the rule in general is that the children are not to be put to death for the sins of the fathers. The fathers then should stand and be responsible for their sin. Every man should be put to death for his own sin. We can see where this principle would be desirable even today, when children tear up property and break the law in some way or another, then they should have to make some kind of restitution that would require them to work, put out effort, make sacrifice or whatever, so that they then could get some idea of the damage that they had done and learn a sense of responsibility. Verse 17, this is really talking to the judges. Thou shalt not pervert the judgment of the stranger, nor of the fatherless, nor take a widow's raiment to pledge. But thou shalt remember that thou wast a bondman in Egypt, and the Lord thy God redeemed thee thence. Therefore I command thee to do this thing. Judgment was to be rendered in such a way that true justice would be done. Just because a person happened to be a stranger, or a fatherless person, that is an orphan, or a widow, doesn't mean that the judges had any right to pervert their judgment. They had as much right to have fair and just dealings as anybody else. So he takes special care in this verse to name the fact that the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow should not have the judgment perverted. They should not be abused by the law in any way, and partiality or favoritism was not to be shown. Now we know that this is one of the crowning defects of the law of most nations. That is that those who are poor, those who do not have any influence, do not have any way to bring any pressure to bear politically, they then suffer at the courts because they are not given a fair deal like they should be. And he gives the reason for this in verse 18, but thou shalt remember that thou wast a bondman in Egypt, and the Lord thy God redeemed thee thence. Therefore I command thee to do this thing. So because God had been so good to them and taken them out of their bondage and treated them in such a way as to make them a nation when they were nothing, then he wants them then to remember this thing by treating their fellow men with justice. The next group of laws, which begins in verse 19, are very interesting, and also they had a very beneficial function. When thou cuttest down thy harvest in thy field, and hast forgot a sheaf in the field, thou shalt not go again to fetch it. It shall be for the stranger, for the fatherless, and for the widow, that the Lord thy God may bless thee in all the work of thine hands. So, we see here that they were not to consider every last bit of the crop to be theirs. It was according to God's law for them to leave some, to leave an occasional sheaf for the stranger, or for the fatherless, or for the widow. So this was a way that people could do good to others, and it really wouldn't cost them anything, because who's going to be the poor if they leave an occasional sheaf in the field? It also was a way to help somebody else, and really you didn't know who you were helping. So you couldn't say, now I want to know anybody I help. I want to know every last detail about the situation. If they're not worthy of help, I'm not going to give it to them. You couldn't say that, because this person you would probably never see. You would probably never get any thanks. You wouldn't know how much benefit it really was, but you had a true love in your heart for your fellow man to leave this. And that's what God intended, that the Lord thy God may bless thee in all the work of thine hands. And the same principle held with other crops besides just the sheaf in the field, which had to do with the grain. Verse 20, when thou beatest thine olive tree, thou shalt not go over the boughs again. It shall be for the stranger, for the fatherless, and for the widow. When thou gatherest the grapes of thy vineyard, thou shalt not glean it afterwards. It shall be for the stranger, for the fatherless, and for the widow. So you see, this principle remains fairly constant throughout the Bible, that God wants some provision to be made for the stranger, for the fatherless, and for the widow. He seemed to have a very special dispensation, a very special feeling for those that are in the position of being strangers, or fatherless, or widows. And truly, all of us may sometime another be in a position to be counted as a stranger, or a fatherless, or even a widow. In the New Testament, in James 1:27, this very same principle is in mind when James says, "Pure religion and undefiled before God and the Father is this, to visit the fatherless and the widows in their affliction, and to keep himself unspotted from the world." So there again, James is talking about the fatherless and the widows. Now, the stranger is a little different in the New Testament times because we're not a nation that has boundaries, and anybody who happens to be born outside the boundary happens to be a stranger. But we also do have strangers, and the New Testament teaches very plainly about showing hospitality. And that would be the same principle as giving here to the stranger. In the last verse of the 24th chapter of Deuteronomy, "And thou shalt remember that thou wast a bondman in the land of Egypt, wherefore I command thee to do this thing." Here again, the idea that you've been in a similar position yourself, you've been a stranger, you've been a bondman, you've been depressed or oppressed, and I delivered you, I brought you out, I made you a nation when you were nothing. And so, because of that, I want you then to have this type of an attitude toward your fellow man. So a very beneficial rule, so that the rich, or those who had plenty, would be allowed then to make some kind of provision to help those who didn't have enough. We're now ready to begin in chapter 25 of Deuteronomy.